From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. HIV and AIDS continue to be a persistent public health issue, and some call Atlanta the epicenter of the problem in the United States.
It's horrifying. I mean, frankly, we have had a smoldering epidemic here for a long time.
On today's show, we'll look at some of the reasons why HIV is still spreading in the South and how insurance companies may be making it worse. That's coming up this hour. But first, on Friday, Emory Professor Rosemary Garland Thompson talked about the need to change the stigma against disability.
Most of us will move in and out of disability in our lifetimes, whether we do so through illness and injury or merely the process of aging.
And here are your first thoughts.
Hi, this is Saeed Merjerdian from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm one of the founders of an app called Paraperks that's trying to help people with mobile impairments around the country to be able to rate and review establishments based on how easy they are to access. I think that helping people with disabilities is all about improving access and sharing knowledge.
Phoebe Robertson brings up the costs associated with being disabled. She helps take care of her three grandchildren, all of whom have autoimmune conditions.
I drive an hour and a half each way every week to relieve their child care person. Both parents work. There are a lot of medical expenses. My daughter's family can't afford to pay me for this time, and I can't get a regular job if I continue to do this for her.
Boy, hang in there, Phoebe. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We might feature your comments on the show. The HIV/AIDS epidemic in the U.S. is not the crisis that it was in the 80s and 90s. Testing and treatment options have improved greatly, but people are still dying. And the Atlanta metro area has one of the highest rates in the nation for new diagnoses. On Second Thoughts, Sean Powers explains why.
Get the result in 1 minute.
I already got tested.
We know, but get tested again. Know your status. Participate. Raise awareness.
It's about 1:30 in the morning in Atlanta's old Fourth Ward neighborhood. It's the weekend, and lots of people are leaving and going to bars. Gary Jerkins of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation is out there in a large HIV testing van. He's passing out condoms and candy.
So we pass out lifesavers, and we tell people that the test can be a lifesaver. We pass out dum-dums, and we say, don't be a dum-dum, know your status. And we pass out Smarties. Smarties get tested, know your status.
Jerkins says every status is good, whether positive or negative, if it means halting the spread of HIV. Atlanta is the fifth highest metro area for rates of new HIV diagnoses, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Nick Carlisle is with the Southern AIDS Coalition.
Well, you know, so in many ways, the South is really, you know, the epicenter of the epidemic, and really Atlanta is the epicenter of that.
23-year-old Lamar Yarborough remembers his diagnosis. It was on his 18th birthday. A couple of days earlier, he had been rushed to Atlanta's Grady Hospital. I recently met up with him at a busy deli in Midtown Atlanta.
2 days before my birthday, I fainted in the shower, and my mother, she rushed me to the hospital. And when she rushed me to the hospital, I went to the doctors, and I had everyone standing around me. You know, Grady, you know, partners with Emory, so, you know, you have a whole bunch of medical students. So it was like, you know, eight people around me, you know, asking me questions. They told me that I had AIDS, and then they were asking me, do I know what that is, and things of that nature, and at the time, I did not.
Yarborough says the virus was sexually transmitted. He had been sleeping with both men and women. He also developed a type of cancer tied to HIV. He says within his family, talk about sex was confined within heterosexual relationships. Sex ed in school wasn't much better.
Pretty much within the South, we do an abstinence-only teaching. And if you were to catch an STD, I remember the video. I mean, it was like, you know, the steam rising. You had to be in a dark alley, you know, the girls with the short skirts on, guys with the sagging pants. And I remember, like, you know, friends and I, we kind of checked out because, like, that's not us, you know. We talk proper, you know. I mean, we do what we're supposed to do. It just didn't apply to us.
Now he's more vocal about the importance of being able to identify with someone on how to handle HIV.
You don't have a lot of people who are advocates, who are African-American men that I've seen, you know, growing up. we are dying from this. And so therefore, it makes me step up to the plate and say, I need to be a leader and to educate my fellow people of color so that we don't die from this epidemic.
Death from AIDS is still a reality for many young African Americans. Dr. Abigail Hankin-Way oversees the HIV testing program at Grady Hospital, where Lamar Yarborough was diagnosed.
We've had patients who were diagnosed on the first same visit that they died of their complications, which is obviously not the way we should be doing it in 2015.
She says at Grady, there are anywhere between 15 and 20 new HIV diagnoses a month. In about half of all cases, the patient already has AIDS, which she says for some patients can take about a decade to develop.
We do have the patients who, despite the possibilities of treatment, are going to be diagnosed extraordinarily late and too late to get the benefit of treatment.
The CDC says the South has the greatest number of people living with the disease and dying from it. Emory researcher Patrick Sullivan used to oversee HIV surveillance at the CDC. He says black men who have sex with other men in Atlanta are three times more likely to become HIV positive than whites, and that's despite having a similar number of sex partners.
That finding was related to two things. One was the racial composition of their sexual network. In other words, they had more black partners. Those black partners are more likely to be living with HIV. And the other was access to health insurance.
Medicaid is the largest source of coverage for persons living with HIV and AIDS, says Nick Carlisle of the Southern AIDS Coalition. Carlisle says not expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which is the case in Georgia, keeps some people from getting tested.
The bigger issue, and I think the bigger issue where Medicaid comes in, is so many people are being diagnosed late. And I think that's one of the signs of not having access to routine health care, not being part of a culture that establishes a primary care doctor and encourages folks to have an annual checkup.
For those already diagnosed with HIV, there is a safety net. It's the federal Ryan White Care Act, and it's available to people who are HIV positive and don't have any health coverage.
But that safety net is vulnerable. It's subject to appropriations every year, and if and when the Ryan White Care Act goes away and Medicaid hasn't been expanded, you're talking about a disaster for people living with HIV in the South.
Lamar Yarborough relies on the Ryan White Care Act to cover the cost of his antiretroviral medication. He's unemployed and doesn't qualify for Medicaid in Georgia.
For me, just personally, if Ryan White ever went away, then hopefully, God willing, I will be financially stable to pay for them myself.
That story originally aired last year. Since the worst of the AIDS crisis in the 80s and 90s, a class of medications known as antiretroviral drugs have helped turn HIV/AIDS from a certain and rapid death sentence to a chronic condition, something that people can live with for decades. But doctors say patients need to take the medications without any interruptions, very important, or else the virus could cause serious problems. 2010's Affordable Care Act, of course, requires everyone to have health insurance. And in exchange, the law requires insurers to cover everyone regardless of pre-existing conditions. Companies have to cover everyone the same and at the same price. But an Atlanta organization claims that's not happening. The AIDS Research Consortium of Atlanta, ARCA, filed a complaint last week with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights. ARCA says an analysis that it did along with Harvard Law School's Center for Health, Law, and Policy Innovation found that two health insurance companies in Georgia, Cigna and Humana, are forcing HIV patients to pay more for their medications than they would for other drugs. With me to explain is Dr. Melanie Thompson, Principal Investigator at the AIDS Research Consortium of Atlanta. Good morning, Doc.
Good morning, Adam.
So explain what that means. Drugs naturally cost lots of different prices, and therefore the copays that patients pay for different drugs are going to be different, and that's not a problem in and of itself. What's the problem here?
Well, the problem here is that these two insurers, Cigna and Humana in Georgia, have put all of the recommended HIV treatments at the very highest cost-sharing level. And people are probably familiar that medications are on different tiers, tier one through tier four or five. Well, all of the HIV recommended medicines are on tiers four and five for these insurers. And that means that patients bear a very large cost share for those medications. And it's unaffordable for many people with HIV.
How did your organization start looking into this?
Well, really, after the Affordable Care Act went into effect and the marketplace was established online, we were, first of all, very excited that people with HIV could be covered by insurance who had never had insurance before. And so we were very excited to get people signed up. But then we began to hear issues. So at many clinics, we were being told that patients were coming back and saying, well, I have insurance, but I went to the pharmacy and they wanted me to pay $800 for my medicines, and I don't have that kind of money, so I left. And, you know, this was not an isolated story. We began to hear all sorts of stories like this, and we wanted to really look into it and do something about it. And we partnered with the Harvard Law School's Center for Health Law and Policy Innovation, CHILPI, and we had been working with them on some other projects, and we partnered with them in 2014 to begin looking at this. And in 2015, we put together a group of advocates here in Atlanta, and we analyzed 45 of the healthcare plans, really all of the silver healthcare plans in the marketplace, to try to find out how insurers were handling medications.
And again, what you found is that these two Georgia insurers, well, insurers that are operating in Georgia, Humana and Cigna, are essentially charging HIV patients the maximum that they can charge them for this class of drugs, which suggests potentially discriminatory policies on their part. We reached out to both Humana and Cigna and invited them to participate today. We have not heard back from them. Humana officials have provided brief statements to a couple other news outlets saying that they do plan to comply with all regulations and work with patients to mitigate costs. They say that these drugs just cost a lot, and naturally some of that expense has to be passed on to the patient. Dr. Thompson, is it clear that these insurers are doing something that is against regulation, or are they just sort of exploiting a loophole?
Well, you know, as to the cost issue, what's interesting is that these same insurers provide some other very expensive medicines that are really equally expensive compared with HIV medications, but they provide them at much lower cost. For example, we looked at the cost for some medications for rheumatoid arthritis, and these are medications that are about the same expense level, maybe costing $1,400, $1,500, $1,600 a month. And in the HIV setting, patients are paying $550 a month or more. But
That's a very stark contrast.
But for rheumatoid arthritis, they're paying $60 a month.
We'll have to leave it there. Dr. Melanie Thompson, we'll see how your complaint shakes out with the feds. You're the principal investigator at the AIDS Research Consortium of Atlanta. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the Jim Crow South, there were some communities that integrated their police departments with African-American officers. On one hand, these officers were authority figures who maintained law and order. And on the other hand, they were denied basic human rights by the very communities that they swore to protect and serve. Author Thomas Mullen of Decatur, Georgia, has written a new historical novel that explores the struggles that Atlanta's police force went through as it integrated in 1948. The novel is called Dark Town, and it comes out tomorrow. Thomas Mullen, congrats on the release, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with the history before we get to the historical fiction. This actually happened in 1948. What prompted the Atlanta PD to integrate?
Sure. So for many years, leaders of Atlanta's black community had been asking the mayors, various mayors, for black cops, and they were routinely put off. And it wasn't until the mid-40s when Mayor Hartsfield was in charge, he told a number of black leaders, look, go get 10,000 black votes and then we'll talk. And it was a pretty savvy thing for him to say because at the time, African-Americans couldn't vote in the Democratic primary, which is really the only election that mattered in the one-party South. Then in the mid-40s, the Supreme Court ruled that all white primaries were unconstitutional. And as a result of that ruling, black community leaders like John Wesley Dobbs, whose grandson Maynard would become Atlanta's first black mayor in the 1970s, they spearheaded a vast voter registration effort, and they wound up registering 18,000 black Atlantans for the vote. And it had a huge impact on that year's municipal elections. Sure. And so then Dobbs and people like Martin Luther King Sr. and Reverend Holmes Borders went back to Mayor Hartsfield and said, okay, you wanted 10,000 votes. We got 18,000. We'd like our cops now. And so finally, in April of 1948, the city did hire 8 black police officers.
But these were police officers who only patrolled black neighborhoods, right?
Yeah, because it was still the Jim Crow era, there were still a number of restrictions that they had to operate under. And that's really what fascinated me and made me feel that this would be a great setting for a novel. First of all, they could only patrol black neighborhoods. They could not drive squad cars. They could only walk their beat. They were not even allowed to use the headquarters. A Newsweek article that came out in 1947, so 1 year before this, estimated that about 1/4 of Atlanta police officers were members of the Ku Klux Klan.
Jeez.
Yeah, so the mayor and the police chief were very afraid that if these black officers showed their faces in the headquarters, the white cops would attack them and they would have a race riot in the Atlanta Police Department. So for the officers' own safety, they were not allowed to set foot in the headquarters. They had to instead operate out of a basement precinct that was set up in the basement of the Butler Street YMCA. And last but not least, they could not arrest white people.
Right.
So when I heard about all that, I was just fascinated by all this, the rules I had to operate under, and I thought there'd be an opportunity to write scenes that had never been written before.
Yeah, yeah. How does this topic comport with the other work that you've done as an author in your career?
Well, I've written 2 historical novels and 1 novel that was set, you know, in Washington right after September 11th. I like writing about issues that I think tap into larger issues about what makes us American, what are the unique things that go into this country and make us who we are? And I'd always wanted to write a book about race. And so when I read a history book about Atlanta that mentioned the hiring of the first black cops in 1948, I just thought that was fascinating. I mean, I'm looking for stories of people whose real lives and real struggles illuminate larger issues that go into making us who we are.
You also have talked about having an interest in totalitarian societies, and you looked at the Jim Crow South and saw a totalitarian society.
Yeah. I love a good crime story, and I've noticed over the years, the last 20 years or so, there have been a lot of crime writers who've done really interesting things by taking that basic hard-boiled detective story that, you know, we all know and love, and they give it a twist by putting it in a totalitarian society. So there's an entire book series set in Moscow written by an author named Martin Cruz Smith. His first book was called Gorky Park. It came out in the early 80s. And it's about this, you know, loyal, noble, moral cop trying to do the right thing, but he's working in the Soviet Union where, you know, his bosses, you can never trust what his bosses say, and civilians are always afraid to talk to him because they're afraid if they say the wrong thing, the secret police is going to knock on their door in the middle of the night and whisk their family away to a concentration camp. You know, it takes the basic moral dilemma of the detective, where supposedly a detective is this upright hero trying to find truth and justice in a dark and corrupt world, and it kicks it up a notch when the entire society is, you know, so corrupt as the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. There's another great writer named Philip Kerr who's written a whole series about a good detective trying to stay alive in Nazi Germany, and I just think that's a fascinating juxtaposition. So as I was researching this time period, I realized, as you said, you know, the Jim Crow South was the totalitarian society if you were an African American. You had no vote. You had no recourse in the legal system. You lived in fear. You never knew when, you know, a neighbor might inform on you, when something might be taken the wrong way and it could just ruin your life or have you killed. And I thought that that would be an interesting way to—it gave me an opportunity to put a twist on the detective story, but also set it right here in Atlanta, just going back in time a few decades.
My guest is author Thomas Mullen. His new book, Darktown, comes out tomorrow. It's a novel that uses the integration of the Atlanta Police Department in 1948 as its backdrop. What are your fictionalized elements?
Well, the main story, it's a murder mystery. One of the very first scenes, 2 of the black rookies see a car being driven erratically, and they they stand in front of it and flag it down, and they find that it's to their surprise, it's a white driver driving on Auburn Avenue late at night. They hadn't expected to see a white man in this part of town, but his passenger is a young black woman, and it looks like she's been hit in the face recently.
And as you said, these black officers could not arrest white people, so this would present them with a conundrum.
Exactly. He pretty much tells them off. He says, "You have no power over me," and he drives away. They manage to call in two white cops to pull him over, but the white officers just kind of pal around with him, and they let him drive away. They don't even give him a traffic citation. And then 2 days later, these same black rookie cops find that woman's dead body. She's been shot and killed probably that same night. And so they need to try to figure out what happened. Were the two white cops who pulled that driver over complicit? Was that driver the killer? You know, what was going on? So that is all fictionalized. The main plot that I came up with, you know, is fiction. But I wanted to make sure that I stayed true to the history in terms of all the rules that the officers had to operate under. I wanted to get the political mood of the era correct. I wanted to make sure that, you know, these characters felt real, that they weren't voicing opinions that would feel like something somebody would say in 2016, but was instead grounded in the way different people felt in 1948. And there was, you know, a great diversity of opinion. I think when we look at history, we sometimes fall into a trap of thinking that, you know, today we're very divided and today we're very polarized, but back in this other time period, it was different. And that's not really true. There's always been great disagreements. And so in 1948, there were a lot of different opinions within the black community about the best ways to fight against Jim Crow South. And, you know, there were a lot of different opinions in the white community about how to maintain segregation, whether to maintain segregation. So I wanted to be true to life in those respects while telling, you know, a fictionalized crime story.
Thomas Mullins, you're a white guy, I think, as far as I can tell.
I am.
Okay. You know, when you're writing a book about the integration of the Atlanta Police Department, about black officers and their experience of the Atlanta Police Department, and it's a work of historical fiction, is there ever a feeling in your mind, a concern, maybe this isn't my story to tell?
I thought about that. There are four main characters in this book. Two of them are black and two of them are white. And so, you know, if a white writer can't write that book, well, then who can write that book? I disagree with the idea that writers should only write about characters who are demographically similar to themselves. Because if you say that, you know, I'm a white person, so I should only write about white people. Well, I'm also a straight white male, so maybe I should only write about straight white male characters. And I'm also a straight white male born in Rhode Island who moved to Atlanta, so maybe I should only write about straight white males born in Rhode Island who moved to Atlanta. You get narrower and narrower until basically we're all just writing memoir, or we're all writing that kind of thinly veiled autobiographical fiction. And that's never been the kind of writer I want to be. I think what makes fiction work is that we're able to see the world through other characters' eyes. Fiction is a very empathetic art form. And if I want readers to take that empathetic leap with me and see the world through the eyes of a character who might be a different race from them, a different gender from them, alive in a different time period from them, you know, I need to do the same thing too. It wouldn't be fair for me to ask readers to take that empathetic leap if I don't do it, and if I'm only writing about thinly veiled versions of Thomas Mullin. So I think race is an extremely important issue in America today, just as it was in 1948. And as an artist, I want to grapple with these issues. I think that really, you know, artists of all gender and race should feel free to write about these things. If they do it, I think, from a place of respect and do their research. And I did spend a lot of time researching Atlanta in 1948 and the various things that were going on then.
I understand there's a chance that that your new novel, Darktown, that we're talking about here, could be adapted into a TV series.
Yeah, there is. Amy Pascal for Pascal Pictures and Sony Television have acquired the rights, and Jamie Foxx has signed on as an executive producer.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm very excited. I think it would make a great show. And I planned this out as a book series because it's set in 1948. It's really right before the big victories of the Civil Rights Movement. And I thought that was really intriguing to me, that I could write a book series that would span the progress of the Civil Rights Movement, which would also mean taking a look at, you know, the white backlash and how that evolved over time. I think that's an important story. And again, getting at the fact that, you know, I'm a white man, but I think the Civil Rights Movement moves hand in hand with white backlash. And those are two hugely important issues that I think have made us the country we are today. So because I was seeing it as a book series, I think some people in Hollywood saw it as a TV series. So yeah, I think it would be great. I hope it happens. I hope they get to shoot it in downtown Atlanta.
Except downtown Atlanta doesn't really It doesn't look that similar to how it looked in 1948. I wonder if there are particular challenges in writing about the history of your city, of Atlanta, in a city that doesn't think about its history that much.
Well, I mean, I guess I would disagree with that a little bit. I mean, you're right, definitely. Atlanta looks a lot different than it did in 48.
It's a city that looks forward, has a history of looking forward, right?
And I think you could say the same thing about America. I think that's something that makes us American, is we're always looking forward. We're always striving. You know, the American dream is that it doesn't matter where you're from, it's where you're going. And, you know, I like that philosophy. I like that about America. I like that kind of go-getter attitude. But at the same time, you know, I am a student of history and I find our history fascinating. So on the one hand, yeah, you could say that in Atlanta, we don't talk about history much. We're more concerned with putting up new skyscrapers and tearing down old buildings. But at the same time, it's hard to live in Atlanta and not think about the civil rights movement a lot and not think about the Civil War with the Martin Luther King Center, the Center for Civil and Human Rights, with Sweet Auburn, with all the Civil War monuments. You know, as somebody who moved here only 8 years ago, I was struck by the region's deep history. So, you know, I totally see what you're saying. Part of being American means looking forward, but I think we always need to remember where we're coming from.
Thomas Mullen's book is Dark Town. It comes out tomorrow. He's speaking tonight at 7 at the Margaret Mitchell House in Atlanta. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now let's move across the state to hear from one of the first African-American police officers in Savannah. About 70 years ago, 9 black police officers joined that city's police department. They became known collectively as the Original 9. Retired Lieutenant John White was the first to take the oath and is the only surviving member of the Original 9. He spoke with On Second Thoughts' Linda Chen about breaking the color barrier in the Savannah Police Department.
My mother and father went down to City Hall to await the arrival of the rest of the nominees. And I was there too early. So Mayor Kennedy stated, well, while we are waiting, I'll swear you in. So he swore me in before the other 8 arrived. And then we, all 8 of us, were sworn in together as the first black police officer in the state of Georgia. When we first got on, we had a lot of hostility. We were not allowed to walk in a white neighborhood in uniform. Back then, they didn't want us to wear no guns, only carry a nightstick. We had to go over to the precinct, change clothes into uniform, and to be picked up and carried down to the barracks. And they would send the rookies to take us to court. And they would stay at the precinct. Then we'd come back and wash the car out. Now they put the junk and everything in the back seat of the car, but they never washed it out, but they washed it out whenever we got into it. Oh yeah, I've been shot at more times than I got pinned, but not hit. I got tired of being cursed, being pushed. Many days I thought of quitting. But my papa said, stick there. Don't quit. Because you are changing the course of history. We walked about 8 years before we got in a patrol car. That's from 1949 until 1958. I was the first driver of that patrol car. And it was a pleasure, an honor, to get in. At that time, the patrol car didn't have broken windows, no floorboards, and we were proud. I spent 38 and a half years as a police officer. Of all the originals, all have deceased. I'm the only one living today. We caught hell, the 9 of us. It's worth it. And they made it possible to have what we have today, black chief of police, assistant chief of police. The whole city changed.
That story was produced by Linda Chen. Soul legend and Macon's own Otis Redding would have turned 75 this month. There was an amazing concert in his honor last night at the Macon City Auditorium. On tomorrow's show, we're going to celebrate him and other Georgia artists for a full hour on music from Macon. And we want to hear from you. What are your favorite Otis Redding songs, your favorite Macon musicians? Call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. History tends to focus on the struggles that Franklin Delano Roosevelt faced one by one in succession. World War II, his declining health, and preparing for a possible successor. But Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Joseph Lelleveld explores these issues simultaneously as Roosevelt experienced them. Lelleveld gets into the mind of the country's longest-serving president in his new book, His Final Battle, The Last Months of Franklin Roosevelt. The last 2 weeks of FDR's life, of course, unfolded at the Little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia. And Joseph Lelleveld will speak at the Carter Center in Atlanta this Wednesday night. And he's my guest this morning. Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
I want to acknowledge just right at the top that presidential health is in the news today. And I am going to ask you later how your research and reporting on this topic informs how you look at current events. But first of all, tell us how this project came about. Why focus on those final months of Roosevelt's life?
I guess it has something to do with my being a senior citizen myself. But I got interested in the question of how he dealt with the whole issue of his own mortality, what kept him going, especially after it became clear that his health was in decline. And ultimately, I think I decided that was the wrong question to put to Roosevelt in retrospect, because he had so many issues he had to face, the war, Stalin, the coming election, he, as I tried to follow his thinking, which is very hard to do because he was a very secretive man, it became clear to me that he addressed all these questions not one by one, but together, because they influenced each other. If he was going to not stand for re-election, then what would have happened to his diplomatic initiatives for the post-war world? Was there any Democrat who could be elected? All these things came together. His health and his mortality was just another issue. He certainly wanted to stay alive. He didn't have a death wish, but he had to. His whole approach to politics and life was to finesse what was in front of him, and that's what he tried to do.
FDR passed away very shortly after he was elected for his fourth term, or when he was inaugurated for his fourth term, I should say. So his condition must have been very serious. Of course, what we know now is that the reality of that condition was quite effectively hidden from the American public for a long time. Do we know the details now? I mean, do we know exactly what happened? Does the historical record now show us what was going on, or were a lot of those records destroyed?
The records were destroyed, and while he did die shortly after his inauguration, big things happened in that short period. He 2 days after that inauguration, he got on a battleship and went to the Mediterranean, and then flew to the Black Sea, and then took a really difficult 5-hour drive on destroyed roads to Yalta to meet Stalin and Churchill. That trip, I think by that time, he must have known that trip was he was putting his life at some risk by going through with that trip. But he was so focused on the idea of creating some kind of world order after the war that victory would mean something. And in terms that are a little anachronistic, he was trying to prevent the Cold War, which we later sailed into. But he saw that danger and thought that he could somehow strike up a relationship with Stalin where they would find a way to deal with each other that produced decent results for both sides.
What kind of a worker was Roosevelt? Was he someone who would just work through the night, his health be damned, or was he someone who was trying to take it easy?
Well, he was told by his doctors in the spring of 1944 that his life depended on his cutting back severely in his work. And he for the most part, followed their instructions and reduced his workload almost by half, which to my mind is clear evidence that he knew the peril he was in.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Joseph Lelleveld. His new book is called His Final Battle, The Last Months of Franklin Roosevelt. Joseph, do we know if the other diplomats, the other world leaders with whom Roosevelt was communicating and negotiating with in this time, were they aware of anything having to do with his condition? I mean, surely sitting in the same room with him, they must have seen that something was going on. And I wonder if that affected the tenor of negotiations.
Well, he had lost a lot of weight in less than a year, something like 25 pounds. And so it showed in his face, and it was understood. It was part of the 1944 presidential campaign, although very few people addressed the issue directly. It wasn't brought into the open. You mentioned Mrs. Clinton's problem this morning. She took sick yesterday, and we knew it within minutes. And
right.
And it's all over the papers today. There was never a moment like that when the papers were full of details of Franklin Roosevelt's decline. On the other hand, remember Roosevelt was a cripple, much worse shape physically in terms of his ability to get around than the American people understood. He couldn't take a step on his own. He couldn't get dressed by himself. There were many things he couldn't do without assistance. His normal conveyance was a wheelchair, and a lot of this was hidden from the American people. So you can say that the long presidency of 12-plus years was, in a certain way, based on concealment. And it's an entirely different... I don't think... He may be our greatest modern president, but I don't think he could possibly, somebody who had all of his attributes, positive and his physical limitations, negative, would find it possible to be elected in this era.
Yeah. How did Roosevelt manage his succession? How did he get his vice president, Harry Truman, read into all of the things that Truman was going to have to deal with, the incredibly consequential times that they were living in?
He didn't. There are two things to be said about that. One is no president had ever briefed a vice president on the central issues of facing the country. The vice president, traditionally up until the time of Truman, was somebody who sat up on the Hill, presided over the Senate, had no office in the White House, and was a half-vanished individual, half-forgotten. The other thing to be said about it is that from the time Roosevelt spent a month on that trip to Yalta, which in some ways ended his life, from the time he got back to Washington in March of 1944 till his death in the following month, he and Truman were in the same place for 21 days only, and they saw each other only two or three times in that period, never alone as far as I can tell. So the opportunity didn't throw itself up. I guess the third thing to say is Roosevelt wasn't planning to die in a month. Yeah. I don't think it matters, though, because once Truman is president, he faces all those issues. He gets briefed thoroughly on Yalta by Roosevelt's top people, and he gets briefed on the atom bomb. And the decisions he has to take are taken in a fairly orderly manner. If Roosevelt had told him what he was hoping to do, I don't know that it would have influenced what Truman did. And the other thing about it is Roosevelt had such a quicksilver mind that he didn't settle on a plan until he was ready to make a decision. So that I don't know what he would have told Harry Truman. It would have taken days.
We're talking to Joseph Lilleveld. His new book is called His Final Battle, The Last Months of Franklin Roosevelt. I want to finish our time together today by talking about FDR's last days in Warm Springs, Georgia. But first, before we get to that, you mentioned, Joseph, that you felt like Truman was able to pick up the ball and run with it and, you know, win the war in the Pacific Theater and do all of that without having been, you know, really briefed or read in or involved by FDR. We focus a lot on presidential health in election years, and we're focusing a lot on it at the moment, the prospect of having an ill president in the White House, a president that could maybe even die in the White House. Presidential candidates or nominees have been getting older lately. This is something that we're going to be talking about more and more. But looking back at history and looking specifically at the experience of FDR, is it really that big of a deal when a president gets sick or dies in office? You know, other people get sick and die, and their businesses and companies and various associations proceed nonetheless.
Well, I think that's a very good question, but it depends a lot on who the president is and who the successor is. Our Constitution is more flexible than it was in 1945, in that we now have an amendment that deals with the question of presidential succession if the president is incapacitated or ill. There's a procedure.
Right. Before, it only dealt with death, right?
It only dealt with death, and so that's one point. But I think that it really depends on who the people are. You know, if it's very different from the British parliamentary system, where if a prime minister were to die in office, he would be succeeded within a day or two by a new leader of his party who would be elected. We don't have that flexibility, and so we were very lucky in the Roosevelt Truman succession, and partly because Franklin Roosevelt. Historians haven't really picked up on this, but Franklin Roosevelt paid some attention to the succession question. He got his second vice president, Henry Wallace, off the ticket for 1944 because he didn't think he'd be a good president. And in the few conversations that have been recorded of what he had to say about Harry Truman, who he hardly knew, one of the questions he asked was, does he have the personality to be president? That meant that he was thinking of a succession and was aware of the possibility that it could happen at any time.
Let's talk about Warm Springs. FDR had gone there for decades following his experience with polio, the warm water he felt eased his pain, exercising in warm water, bathing in warm water. When he goes to Warm Springs at the end of March 1945, do you think that he knows he's going there to die?
I think he's going there to forestall his death. I don't think he's going there to die. But he only went there twice during the war, and in both cases, I think there's strong circumstantial evidence that he went there because it would put him close to his old romantic attachment to a woman named Lucy Mercer, became Lucy Mercer Rutherford, and she lived not far away and not too far away in South Carolina, in Aiken, South Carolina. On both his trips to Warm Springs, Lucy Mercer drove over to spend some time with Roosevelt and spent a few nights in the little White House. and she was there when he collapsed and began to die on April 12, 45.
What were his final days like there?
Quite. At first, he was very weak when he got there, but he rallied and he went to the place. There's a particular lookout near the little White House that he loved to go to, and he went there and he drove around in the neighborhood and you know, did a certain amount of paperwork, but basically he was trying to recover his strength. And if you look at the last photograph taken of him, which we have in the book, taken the day before he died, it's extraordinarily striking. I don't think looking at it you'd necessarily feel that he was a dying man, but he certainly looks hugely different from the way he looked a year earlier.
Well, Joseph Lelieveld is a former correspondent and executive editor of the New York Times. His new book is called His Final Battle, The Last Months of Franklin Roosevelt. Joseph Lelieveld will speak at the Carter Center in Atlanta this Wednesday night. More information about that event is at gpbnews.org. Thank you so much for the chat.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for our show today. But as always, we do want to hear from you. If you could go inside the mind of a historical figure, who would it be? Would it be FDR? Would it be someone else? And for that matter, what do you think about my question about, is it a big deal if a president gets sick and dies? Or is it as big a deal as it is often talked about? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk. Or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee this week. Have yourself a great day.